You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Courtney Coulson. This is Minute 34. This minute opens with Holloway saying, "There's something here generating an atmosphere," and ends with Chance saying, "That, my friend, is terraforming." So I'm joined again by my friend, Dean.
Howdy.
Hello again. And we are still discussing the butthole room where people are taking their helmets off.
The butt courtyard, if you will. Yes. The anti-sphincter chamber.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, man. Why?
So after Holloway says, "There's something here generating an atmosphere, right?" And then he turns to David for backup on this. And David's like, "Yes, definitely. You should definitely take your helmets off. That's a good idea."
It's not a good film to watch again with the benefit of, like, foresight.
Mm.
Because, well, I mean, it is interesting to watch it again, but yeah, that first time, when you don't know what's going to happen with the android, shall we say, you can sit there and you can go, yeah, look at him. He's very agreeable. He's telling us everything's fine. That's a good thing. And then you get to the end of the film and you watch again, you're like, no. No, of course he's saying it's fine.
I really love that about David's performance, or Michael's performance in general, that it's both, and I've said this before, it's both trustworthy and untrustworthy. He seems very capable, he seems very knowledgeable, but something not quite right.
But didn't he spend a whole bunch of time just learning how to walk like an android?
Yes.
Just for that epic uncanny valley effect that you're talking about?
That is something that a lot of actors who have portrayed androids are missing. Just, yeah, that uncanny valley. I very rarely watch a movie or a TV show or play a video game about androids and go, yep, totally believe that's not a human. But Fassbender does it. I don't know what he's doing.
You're right. And so it's really subtle. It's just upsetting because he moves ever so slightly unnaturally. He talks ever so slightly, not quite like a person, but almost.
It's a little too precise. Yeah, because he doesn't talk in a really formal way. It's not like Data in Star Trek The Next Generation, where he can't say contraction, so it's do not, cannot, all that. No, both David and Walter have fairly conversational ways of talking in terms of the words, but the way they're it's almost like the Google Home, where there's that, I think I've mentioned in the podcast already, where they had a demonstration of their AI booking a haircut.
Oh yeah, Duplex, I think they call it.
Mm.
Yeah, and the woman on the other end of the phone was none the wiser.
Yeah.
Just thought it was a very formal person, I suppose.
Which, and it wasn't even that formal. It really had those arms, and in some ways it is closer to mirroring people than David does, which is fascinating.
He doesn't really say or ah, does he? It's funny no. I'm adding that makes it that much more human.
Not even Wells and stuff. Obviously, I've paid a lot of attention to the way the androids talk, and Walter is a little bit more casual. He's kind of got this, I don't know, like, southern thing going on, so he seems a little more relatable. It's the English accent. It's just a little too precise.
Mm-hmm. All bad guys are English.
Yep. Oh, yeah, the movements. It's almost like hydraulics or something, that real smooth action.
Yeah, it's a good point. It does imply power that's being wielded very carefully, the way he moves. It does kind of make you think of like a forklift or something being operated.
Yeah, like an economy of movement. When I see him, well, it seems to be coming from the upper thigh and the knee. Whereas I think when humans normally walk, it's the whole leg. We're using the whole leg, whereas he's trying to move from one point, which I guess for a robot, it's using less energy, maybe? I don't know.
Perhaps. He just moves in a really interesting way that makes you uncomfortable, I would say, as a casual observer.
But in this scenario, the thing that's making us uncomfortable is that he's just like, yeah, do the dangerous thing all the way. Mm. They take their helmets off, and of course the audience loses their collective goddamn minds. And I think from a practical scenario, it is incredibly difficult and uncomfortable to shoot an entire film with the lead characters wearing helmets. I honestly can't think of an example where that's been done.
No, I mean, The Martian, he takes it off. Yeah. I haven't watched in a long time, but 2001.
Yeah, no, they don't have helmets the whole time. There's a lot of scenes in that movie Life, which was quite forgettable, the one with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds. A lot of helmet scenes, but not always.
Yeah.
Moon, hardly any.
Gravity, I think.
Gravity, yeah.
I haven't actually seen that, but I imagine they take their helmets off for a lot of that.
Yeah. Interstellar. Yeah, you always, if you're having a lot of dialogue scenes, you're always going to have to take those helmets off. It would be weird otherwise. I mean, if they really wanted to do it, I guess you could just CGI the helmet the whole time. That's expensive.
Mm.
Well, being a cosplayer for a long time. Any sort of helmet, especially when it's completely covering your head and it's clear, it's just condensation, sweat, fog, everything. You can't, you know, touch your face, which you don't notice until you can't do it, that you do it a lot. So in this particular instance, there's no getting around the fact that they just had to do this for practicality's sake, that it's not a Kylo Ren type mask where you can't see all the condensation. It is a clear dome. There's a reason why you don't see those in movies very often.
But kind of, to me, it's an important point, because we've talked about this a lot off mic, that a lot of what I personally enjoy about Prometheus and Covenant,
yeah,
is that they do have little imperfections and little things that, like you say, you kind of get a sense that they might have just done it for practicality.
Yeah.
In shooting the film, and it gives you a lot to think about. And I don't think it's really a bad thing. I don't think it detracts from anything.
No, I'd agree with that. I kind of prefer a movie that does have some flaws, that you go, well, why'd they do that? Or they could have done this instead, or, well, okay, so if this is like that, does that apply to all these other things? Yeah, I prefer a movie that's sort of, it's almost there. It's like a 3.5 to 4 star out of 5 star film.
I think one of the core, really important parts about this particular flaw, though, is that it doesn't treat the audience like they're idiots. Like, they are trying desperately, as we've talked about, the writers, to convey the message that we know they're taking their helmets off. We know everyone's going to freak out.
It's self-aware.
It's trying to put it all together in a way that makes sense, whereas the flaws I can forgive in movies that I kind of enjoy are, to do with sets, to do with, you know, maybe you see the boom in shot once. That's okay. As opposed to bad writing,
where
the flaws exist in the script and we're all just meant to pretend that we didn't notice the giant gaping plot hole.
I think the only problem here is, as you were mentioning in the last minute, that it wasn't meted out. It wasn't slowly... we're getting a trickle of information, so it's just like, we can take our helmets off now! I think definitely do it!
Yeah, I think it might have helped if they had spend a bit more time on buttering up the audience to deal with the helmets coming off.
In not too many minutes, actually, we will have that moment that people make fun of at Justice March, where Milburn puts his face right up to the vagina snake, and it's like, oh, hello, I want to play with you. So I think that's one that there will be a lot of debate over forever, but I do think that that one is a problem because it didn't serve any practical purpose. Whereas this one, I get it. I get why it had to be done.
And like you say, the other challenge that we have as well is the fact that the writers for these films presume that you have seen the previous Alien movies. And characters have had to deal with this before, being exposed to dangerous environments, being exposed to, like you say, something that seems harmless and then is suddenly very much not harmless. And you can't just deal with it in exactly the same way as the previous films. It feels like it's the same thing repeating. You have to kind of make it a little bit different.
If you just had a bit of a line where Shaw... Well, she does say that it's an invitation, that the engineers have invited human beings to this planet, and this place is clearly being terraformed, the air is breathable. She believes they're expected, so why would there be any hesitation? They should probably go, looks like they were right, that our predictions were correct, that, this environment was made for us.
I would imagine it's the sort of giant ship with rib cages and sphincter courtyards. I mean, that would definitely give me pause.
But I think Shaw being the true believer, I could kind of see her being the first one to take her helmet off, or being, you know, going along with Holloway and both doing it at the same time. But everyone else going, I don't know about that.
It's interesting, actually, that you mentioned that, because I think there are definitely cues that would give even a true believer pause. Suddenly Shaw's commitment is questioned, and that Holloway has to be the one who decides to roll the dice and...
Been debating this for a while, going, okay, so Holloway is the adventurous one, he's the reckless one, but Shaw is also the true believer. She's diving headfirst into this because she is so convinced of what little evidence she has. She is fully committed to this whole engineer story. So, yeah, I feel like maybe character-wise, both of the, in terms of what fits their character... Yeah, both of them should have been like, yeah, this makes sense, let's do it.
I mean, possibly. I think it's quite interesting to investigate the idea of a true believer and the difference between, you know, believing really hard from the comfort of a spaceship versus believing really hard from inside the belly of the beast.
It's one of those things that's hard to convey. I think in a novel, you could definitely go through a character's psychology a bit more and go, suddenly she started to doubt her... beliefs, or she suddenly felt less confident about this, whereas in watching a movie you sort of have to fill in those blanks. So yeah, maybe she is having a bit of a crisis of faith or whatever.
I mean, you'd have to go back and, like you said, look for very subtle facial expressions in the film, which might be there, but
being autistic, I don't know, I must be missing so much in this movie.
It's possible, and I haven't watched it for a very long time, so yeah. I can't help.
This is why I occasionally have guests on. I feel the original Alien, you know, it's slower paced. It is somehow more deliberately paced, and yet there is so much being conveyed in every single minute. And it amazes me that the pacing of films these days, so modern cinema, say 2010s onwards especially, there's a lot going on. It moves at a fast pace, but not a lot's being said. That real important stuff isn't there.
It's interesting. I mean, perhaps when you've only got a budget of, you know, whatever you could scrounge up because the studio didn't want to give you much, you have to really convey a lot without showing much or doing much.
True.
You have to do it with the cast and sort of conversation and facial expressions and writing. Whereas when you do have some giant special effects budget and your characters are all standing on an alien planet with suits on inside a ship... you've got a lot you want to squeeze into the shots because you paid for it, which may not advance the plot, potentially.
Just something that seems to naturally happen. It doesn't matter what production it is. If you've got that exorbitant amount of money to play with, you'll get distracted. And so in this movie, I think I mentioned to you that the suit Vickers wears is the most rare... fabric on the face of the earth and would have cost thousands of dollars for something that's on screen for a few scenes, like a couple of scenes. And found out recently that the little smiley face badge in Watchmen, there are about three of those made, and they cost a few thousand dollars because they filmed it in IMAX, so you had to print it in like in insane resolution.
Right.
Then they had to coat it in something that wouldn't be too reflective. Because you don't think about, like, you see just a badge. You know, in real life, it's not too shiny, but on camera, it's white.
Yeah, there's a discussion I was watching recently. I think it was about video games or 3D film, where they were talking about the fact that you have to... No, I think you might have told me, actually.
Oh, okay.
Basically, you have to create things in an environment for a 3D animated movie in such a way that they appear correct to the human eye.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that, you know, left to its own devices in a 3D environment, it doesn't behave like a real world object. Mm. And like you say, you're kind of having to reverse engineer that with something like the badge in Watchmen, where you know what the real thing appears like on a camera, but you also know what it appears like to the human eye.
Yeah.
And the same thing appears differently in both scenarios, so now you have to reverse engineer something that looks correct to the camera. Yeah, that's an interesting scenario.
Yeah, it's crazy that I think a lot of people just overlook these little technical things where, yeah, this object looks fine to my eyeballs, but you put it on camera, it looks wrong. So then you have to try and fool the camera or fool the audience into thinking that is how it should be. And yeah, you wouldn't even think about it.
There's a lot of work that goes into that as well. I mean, most people probably don't even know what the word grading is.
Yeah.
Not just grading, just that part of filmmaking to make stuff look like it's supposed to look, despite how it looked on set that day, is fascinating.
Oh yeah, colour on film is very fascinating to me. Just the technology behind it and how we have to light everything, and there's a whole art and science to it.
It's a rabbit hole.
So, we're talking about if you have a precedent for something, the audience will be more accepting. In the original Alien script by Dan O'Bannon, Broussard, who was later renamed Kane... Oh, by the way, all the names in the original Alien are hideous. Kane is lowered into the pyramid structure and notices the air inside is completely breathable. To quote, "High oxygen content, no dust, it's completely breathable." Broussard yanks off his helmet and takes a deep breath of the air. I have to wonder, first of all, how the audience in the 70s would have reacted to the scene. Would they have joked about it, or would they have just sort of gone along with it? Because it was a very different time for the genre.
I mean, it's hard to put myself into the shoes of someone who was alive before I was born, but I think people would have been less likely to go, you know, oh, but what about if the oxygen contains some sort of, oh, I don't know, pathogen, for example. Where, you know, space is just such a mind-blowing thing already. That
yeah.
They go, oh, it's like Earth. Okay, I understand Earth. Great, take the helmets off. I don't know.
I mean, they're definitely, there are always, you know, science nerds and sci-fi geeks and all of that who would have had these discussions in, like, fan magazines and stuff. But I guess you don't have that internet hive mind, and I'll talk about that in a minute, just that people will dogpile on something, and to the point that it almost overshadows the actual minor problem. So if we had that scene in the original Alien, then in Prometheus, maybe people will be more accepting to, oh, that's a callback. I think we tend to be more accepting to things that are an homage.
I think so too.
For whatever reason. That internet hive mind. Yeah, we live in a world now where people are outraged because Star-Lord apparently ruined the plan in Infinity War. No spoilers. You know, that, oh, well, he let his emotions, you know, ruin the moment. And, well, you don't want a character making the right decision all the time. That's where the drama and the tension comes from. The other thing is, removing helmets in science fiction is so common. You look at Star Trek, you look at Lost in Space, no one makes that complaint. I just don't get it. I don't know why people got so obsessed with that.
It's an interesting point, actually, and I think it really highlights something very, very subtle and important about filmmaking in general, which is that there's a way to do everything in such a way that the audience just accepts it. As we've talked about again off mic before, there are very not okay things in a lot of films that just because the music is a particular way or something like that, the audience just accepts it because all of the other elements are going along with it. The pacing, the music, the lighting, something makes you go, this is fine. Whereas if you were to see someone doing that just in day-to-day life, you would be horrified. By the same token, taking off the helmets, the way they did it, the way they crammed the kind of, oh, this is all fine, explanation into 30 seconds. There was just something about the way it was done that was apparently jarring enough that, like you say, the entire internet decided to dogpile onto this. I also happen to find it a little bit jarring in this particular film, but yeah, I think the reaction has probably been a little extravagant.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, really, is... And this happens so often with so many other movies, like Jurassic World. I have not seen it, but all I know is, she was wearing heels! It was ridiculous!
That became a very heated discussion at the one time with me.
From what I understand, that character, Bryce Dallas Howard's character, was a woman working basically in a kind of office environment, you know, temperature controlled, carpeted floors, all of that, and then she's suddenly thrown into this crazy dinosaur situation. She wasn't going to work that day in wearing some Timberland boots.
Yeah, I mean, all that's a fair point, but what I find fascinating is just how that can be such a big argument in a film about bringing fucking dinosaurs exactly. back to life. Like, suddenly the dinosaurs are all gone, and now we're trying to work out the logistics of running in heels. And it's a firestorm yeah. of debate, and you just have to wonder why.
Yeah, it is this selective, obsessive devotion to scientific realism or factual realism, but then they exclude certain other things. So in this movie, there are so many, just the pups, for instance. To me, when I was watching it this time around, I was going, those are actually more of an interesting conundrum.
Mm, yeah, right now they're a theoretical physical impossibility.
And yet it's the helmets that people really latched onto. And yes, I think you were right in the previous minute that it's because of the genre. It's because we are conditioned to think any action in this haunted house is going to screw them over. Exactly. Later on.
It's, don't go in there. Don't go in there, man. Like, you know, it's just people screaming at the screen. Mm. Just like, don't take the helmets off.
But again, I mean, that's that Star-Lord in Infinity War scenario of, do you want them to make the right decision? Because that would be boring. Could you imagine, just Prometheus is the tale of an obedient android leading a crew into this wonderful archaeological site. They take some impressions of the mummies. They take some samples of the black goo.
Brunch is served.
They have brunch, they go home.
Mm. Lovely.
Why the fuck would I give a shit?
It's not, yeah, exactly compelling.
Even in, yeah, Alien Covenant, they do away with helmets almost entirely. And I actually think that was a better choice, maybe. That there isn't that debate of should they, shouldn't they. It just wasn't a factor.
And I mean, I think I certainly, personally, was able to accept that a little bit more easily in Covenant, just purely because they're not an advanced sort of expert crew,
yeah.
really. They're sort of just settlers
who they were happen not,
to
yeah.
be in a shit show and have to deal with it, so.
And again, them making the right decision. Well, we don't know what kind of, you know, microbial life could be on this planet. It could wipe us out. You're right, Daniels. Let's go back into cryo. The end.
Exactly. Yeah, just look out the porthole of the spaceship. Go, that looks scary out there. Let's all stay in the ship. End of film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I find fascinating is that people criticize, they will nitpick these little scientific or historical inaccuracies when the real problems of a movie were something more fundamental. And for Prometheus, I think it's structural issues, it's characterization. We don't get a good sense of a lot of these characters, or their motivations seem to just come out of nowhere. And yet, I guess it's harder for people to pick up on those. I guess they're not writers, they're not thinking about it in those terms. They just know, something was wrong, and I can point to this, therefore that's the problem.
It's low-hanging fruit. I mean, they don't even often, I've been guilty of this myself, where you don't even get to analysing the film as a film. You're just having a go at the person running in high heels.
Yeah.
And then someone points out to you, there's a giant genetically engineered dinosaur in the background, and you're having a go at the high heels on, like, gravel?
Yeah.
That's not really, like, there's bigger fish to fry yeah. here. And like you say, really where we should be focusing instead of nitpicking is probably on giant holes in the plot, if they happen to exist.
I'm glad that nowadays we have podcasts like this, or you have a lot of those video essays on YouTube. There are so many people who are very talented at breaking down a script and going, this is why you left this movie dissatisfied. I think there's probably times you've left a movie and gone, it just didn't work. I don't know why. It just didn't.
Yeah, things that you were really expecting to blow your mind, and somehow you just walk out going, meh.
Contemporary interviews for Prometheus. One critic said that when he saw The Avengers, which came out in 2012, that he, in the car ride home, his friends didn't say much. It was just like, oh yeah, that was cool. That was fun, I guess. car ride home after Prometheus, full-on debates like, what did this mean? Should that have happened? Could that have worked if we just changed this? Or just, like, just a really excitable, intense conversation. I want a movie like that. That's going to stay with me.
I agree, and I think, you know, when you talk about Avengers or something like that, if you have one criticism of Disney, which is going to be true in most cases, I feel, it's that it's almost too polished.
It's very safe. And marathoning the Marvel movies, most of them weren't fun to watch again because I just went, I've been here, I've done that. It's
formulaic, it's safe. It's done on purpose. Mm. But it doesn't really lend itself to long-winded debate.
Ridley Scott has an approach where it's just like, I want to put everything in. I've got all these ideas, like, just throw everything in there. So, I mean, a lot of critics do look at these prequels and just go, it's just like everything in the kitchen sink's been thrown in. What are you trying to say? It's making so many historical and cultural references, but it's just like, nah, man, give it to me. I love it.
And you know, I think when that happens, and Mad Max is another example I can think of another IP where the same sort of thing happened, where you've got like 20-something years between films and the directors and the writers are all just chomping at the bit the entire time, just can't help coming up with ideas and stories and stuff, and then finally they get a shot to put it all into something.
Mm.
And like you say, they just cram it to the ceiling with everything they've thought about over the last 20 years.
And I guess it's very rare to get that perfect storm of having that much time, having a studio that trusts you, and, you know, having created this franchise in the first place, where you can come back in and just go, yeah, let's fill this with so much meaning. Every single frame is telling a whole novel-length thing. Yeah, I think I would rather too much than not enough, basically. That I love the Ridley Scotts and the George Millers of the world who really just, they've got so many ideas, they've got so much passion. And yeah, Ridley is not perfect. I think he has made missteps, but fuck, I love him.
So, are we classing then the taking off of the helmets as a misstep? Where do you fall on that?
Thank you for reminding me. So, I have a list that I'm compiling that I will put somewhere at the end, maybe do an episode just looking at that specifically, or maybe rewrite the whole script myself, who knows? But I don't consider it a problem. I think the way it was done was a problem.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that is a really interesting point, that the taking off of the helmet on the alien world shows either a level of commitment where you're willing to put your life on the line, or just casual, reckless, sort of bad boy Holloway-ness. And then you could very easily have the people in the back going, hey man, this is just my day job. I'm not taking this thing off for any reason.
Character should always fuel the plot rather than the plot fueling the characters. In this case, I think the way it was shot feels like plot forcing the characters to do something rather than the characters forcing the plot along.
And perhaps that is a problem when you've had a vision for something like 20 years that you haven't been able to commit to film, and you know in your head how it's got to go down, that you might neglect sort of minor-ish details like maybe the characters don't all want to take their helmets off
because,
you know, they've got families they want to go back to.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is you don't get a sense of the other characters in that moment why they would take their helmets off. I mean, yeah, okay, so they took the Shaw and Holloway do, but I think the other characters should be kind of wary. They go, we didn't even know we were coming here, first of all, until we woke up. We don't trust this place. We don't trust you. We've just met you. So, yeah, it needed to be more of a character moment, and it just wasn't.
Hmm. Even Ridley Scotch has a bad day from time to time, I think.
So, yeah, the minute ends with just Chance and Ravel on the ship talking about, apparently they made a bet that this was going to be a planet that had been terraformed, and that's it. There's not much to say about that, other than I like those characters and I wish they had more to do.
Sure, you sure we can't do like another 40 minutes on that, or?
Well, I mean, if you want to come back for the next minute, you are more than welcome. You can just be my full-time co-host.
Thanks. I mean, I think I could, I could probably slot into this.
All right, so thank you for being on for this week.
No worries at all. Thank you so much for having me.
Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson, signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook.